Hi everyone, so sorry I can't be there in person, if only to be near the beach for a couple of days, but I hope you're having a great conference and I'm really glad that I can speak for a few minutes about this topic. I think that these ideas that you're discussing today are actually some of the most fundamental ones that we can address as a disability rights movement. I know that when I wrote my book Crippled, yes, it's absolutely partly about documenting the impact of austerity on disabled people, but just as much in my mind I was trying to help challenge the myths and the prejudices that helped us get to that point. I think as the left, you know, we talk quite open about the fact that one of the most damaging myths around poverty has always been that it is somehow inevitable. You know, this idea that while some people enjoy a life of fortune, there will somehow always be others who can't afford food. But I think we need to talk about the fact that this is just as strong when it comes to disability. I think that the notion of inevitability for inequality is really central in maintaining the status quo. And briefly today I just want to talk about the three ways that I think this happens when it comes to disability. So firstly, for me, it's about the openly negative way that some people describe disabled people. Most predominantly in recent years, how we've seen people talk about disabled benefit claimants, for example, as, you know, liars or fakers or drained on the taxpayer. And we know, you know, this isn't marginalised language. This isn't fringe stuff. This sort of language, when it comes to disabled people, goes to, you know, the front pages of national newspapers. It's implied in speeches made by cabinet ministers. I think that's had a huge impact on how the public have increasingly perceived disabled people, you know, against this backdrop of squeezed wages and growing anti-welfare culture. In Britain, I think, in the book I talk about how it's the emergence of the undeserving sick, where not only is social and economic disadvantage seen as a sign of personal failure, but also being disabled or ill. And I think that's, you know, enables this vision where people are blamed for their disability, people are blamed for their illness, people are blamed for needing the state to help them stay afloat. And it legitimises a belief that people's support is a cost that the state shouldn't have to pay. I think here we see how toxic myths around class and disability could combine in a way that really uniquely scapegoats disabled working class individuals. I think a second example is the way that disabled people are often viewed as sort of needy and passive and kind of tragic figures. Sometimes this is meant in quite sort of well-meaning ways, but of course is really damaging in its own right. So in the book I talk to this guy called Pete, who's 30 and uses a wheelchair, and he talks to me about how he has had his social care cut in recent years. He was having, you know, round-the-clock care in his own flat, and when it was cut repeatedly, he could no longer safely live in his own home, and it meant that the local authority essentially shoved him into a care home for the elderly. So there he was at, you know, age 30, having to sell his own flat and move into an institution with people who could be his grandparents. And I remember thinking, I cannot imagine a situation where this would happen to a non-disabled person and where it would be seen as normal. But there is something about the perception of disabled people that where we shrug our shoulders and we think, here's a 30-year-old that I've stuck in this home for life and this is somehow a normal, acceptable, slightly sad, but otherwise absolutely okay thing for the state to do to somebody. Because we perceive disabled people still in ways that are so far removed from how we see other autonomous adults who we think should have independent lives of full quality. But somehow, because people are disabled, those things, those qualities, those beliefs, those hopes can go out the window. And I think that, thirdly, where language inadvertently reinforces the idea that disabled people's inequality is somehow inevitable. We've seen in recent years the way that disabled people are routinely described as the most vulnerable. And we hear this a lot when it comes to sort of newspapers, but we also hear it, you know, in speeches made by people on the left who tell us in a really, you know, well-meaning way that even in times of austerity, a decent society, for example, will always protect the most vulnerable. But I think for many of us in the disabled community and on the left, you know, it's incredibly important to talk about the fact that disabled people, you know, don't need to be vulnerable. Contrary to these myths around disability, it's not inevitable for people with disabilities to be afraid or desperate or isolated. You know, vulnerability isn't inherent to illness or disability. Vulnerability comes when politicians choose to pull the support disabled people need in order to live dignified, fulfilling, independent lives. And I think, you know, this seems kind of grim in many ways, because it means, you know, when you realise or talk about the fact that none of this was inevitable, that it was a choice, it means confronting the fact that as a society, we are consistently creating and voting for policies that are willingly, actively harming disabled people. But I think actually, perversely, there's actually huge hope in this as well, because when poverty, discrimination, marginalisation are essentially man-made, it means that human beings are the ones that can fight it. When such hardship is the result of political choices, it means that we can choose to do something better. It means that all of this is up for grabs. And I think that with that in mind, that enables us to argue for radical structural change. It enables us, it empowers us to be able to say that actually the moral but also common sense solution is to invest in the structures that help disabled people live full lives. It enables us to point to the social care system, to the housing, to the social safety net, to the NHS, to mental health services, and point to the fact that all of this is based on what we choose to do with it and how we can make it the most valuable structure it can be to create a society that is fairer but also so much better for all of us. And I think that as Britain's welfare state undergoes, you know, I think what is its greatest challenge yet, I don't think there's ever been a more crucial moment to make that case, to strengthen the social safety net, to demand more from our leaders than more and more cuts, and to fundamentally reject the myth that this is the best that we can do as a society. In my book, I hoped it would be a record of of these times, but when we talk about this, as we are today, it's also about a rallying cry for change. Because I think that right now, when we look at what this country is going through, it is really easy to feel overwhelmed, to feel fatigued by politics, or just to feel hopeless. But I think that now is ultimately the time when we need to grab that hope more than ever. And I think that the biggest sign of hope there is to stick with this argument that none of what we are seeing is inevitable. It is entirely within our collective power to change it, and we can do that as a movement together. Thanks so much.